This is Ron Oral, and you're listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast. And I'm super excited to have back on the show James Rasta, founder and CIO of Coast Capital, a Connecticut-based, sometimes activist fund that is heavily invested in gold miners. Coast Capital is looking to take in an additional $150 million to its Coast Capital Miners Fund, and they're expected to close at $250 million in assets under management at year end. So pretty exciting stuff. Thank you again for speaking to us, James.
Ron, great pleasure to be with you as ever. And at an age of COVID, I think we're based everywhere, right? We're all nebulous and working from the ether. So greetings from Miami, as it turns out.
Okay, great. That sounds like potentially an okay place to be amidst COVID. So tell us a little bit about Coast Capital for those who are not familiar with the fund. How many positions do you have? And just generally, how are you coping with the coronavirus-driven market volatility?
Of course. Look, Coast Capital is a firm that takes a private equity approach to investing in public companies. And what that means for us is we invest in companies that we believe are leaders in profitable and growing industries. And we invest in these companies when they have really low, like pretty well distressed valuation, despite the fact that they have very robust balance sheets and cash flows. We love distressed valuation. And we love to invest in these companies also when there's an event that releases value back to investors. Because invariably, when a really great company has distressed or very low valuation, it's because there's some kind of problem that investors are not pleased with, don't really see a solution to, and therefore are avoiding the company altogether. We get involved and actively help to solve the problem, which may be, you know, operational underperformance. It may be inadequate or improper management. It may be that the assets don't belong together. Whatever the problem is, we invest when there's clearly an attractive solution to it that releases a lot of value to investors, and that is happening independently of our investments, of our being invested in the company, or if we need to, we will actively engage with management and the board and our fellow investors for that solution. So we're long-term investors, 12 positions, you know, we don't really trade around. And so COVID really affected our performance pretty notably, but we reacted violently by doing absolutely nothing. We had a very strong urge to do absolutely nothing because the investments we're making are super esoteric. And we actually last year were up, I think, 58% net.
Okay, congratulations.
So sometimes the turtle does seem to win the race on occasion.
So is it fair to say, James, that you guys will engage with almost all of the companies that you invest in? And when you buy stakes, these are fairly large positions, like 3-5% stakes sometimes, or?
Yeah, 15% stakes. I mean, I think that the upper limits might be about 30, which is the limit above which you have to put a mandatory bid. You're considered an insider and what have you. We try not to breach the upper limits, but that is indeed fair. Yes.
Okay, super. So as we've talked about before on the podcast, Coast Capital does a lot of investments and some activism in Europe. So I'm curious if you expect to launch more activist campaigns in Europe. And I wondered if you could give us the case for activism in Europe. It's interesting. Lazard put out a report that surprised me that they said that, and you know, with a grain of salt, they look at companies with 500 million or more market caps. So there's a whole universe of companies they don't really look at underneath that. But of the ones they looked at, they found that in 2020, the activist campaigns was up by 21% year over year from the previous year, despite the, you know, a global pandemic. So there is a fair amount of activism in Europe. So I'm wondering why that is. So maybe you could give us some thoughts on that, James.
So a couple of things. We're actually actively engaged with every company that we're invested in. It just so happens that with the vast majority of them, we believe that the management team is the right management team. We believe that they're really great, but we're actually engaged in, and I hope helpful in the company going in the right direction. And we're providing our support to management. Sometimes we're creating consensus among our fellow investors around what management is doing. And very often with the companies that we're investing in, we're invited to participate in the capital structure of these companies by management and the board because there's a project that needs financing. And so we invest through a meaningful number of pipes. And so I don't really know that we are like most hedge funds, but when we are actively engaged in a shockingly high portion of our investments, it's very friendly engagement. And it's not like white glove suggestivism. There are very specific things that are happening and we are on board with management, but we have a useful role to play in that process. And we certainly don't like to make a nuisance of ourselves. If we make a nuisance of ourselves, we go all in and we're unbearable global until changes happen. So now activism in Europe, I think that COVID has to have led to the uptick in the number of activist cases, because if you think about it, my peers in Europe, and I've been investing in Europe for 23 years, well over 20 of that 23 years as an activist investor. So I've been doing it as long as anyone I know and longer than most. In fact, I don't know who's been doing activism in Europe much longer than I have, but I have to believe that.
Eyewiser Pratt. No, I don't know. Just,
but God bless him. And maybe, long may he live.
He may Eyewiser be Pratt. Yes, not so right. much lately, but it was going
well. You know that of which you speak, Ron. That is correct. I stand corrected, and I thank you for that. Look, Europeans take their vacations very seriously, okay? Mm-hmm. COVID means, you know, not 3 months in Saint-Tropez doing things that you hope don't make it to page six, gives you a whole lot more time to work, and maybe that explains the uptick in activist investments in Europe, or maybe in general, uptick in productivity on a per hour worked. I don't really know. But tangibly speaking, I think that the case for activism in Europe is certainly much more compelling than it is in North America. It stems from the fact that A, there's a lot less activist capital and a lot more companies that need intervention to create value for investors. And so the demand supply is much more attractive than it is in North America. That's A. B, we talk about Europe like it's one cohesive, kind of maybe charming, kind of weird, and kind of, I think my friends in America think of Europe as a socialist entity, which I think Europe is really greatly misunderstood, particularly in North America and especially in the United States. At the end of the day, there are jurisdictions in Europe that are much more friendly for activist investors to allocate capital to than the United States. Like across most jurisdictions, we don't have staggered boards. We don't have golden shares. We often don't have these golden parachutes, which I think can really muddy the waters for a lot of activist investors. And in countries like the UK, with a 5% stake in a company, you can call an EGM, which certainly you cannot do as a matter of course here in North America or in the US. You can do it in Canada as well. So actually, I find it really interesting that we all think that America is just the greatest market for activists and the most accommodating. Absolutely not the case.
And for those listeners who don't know, EGM, that's an extraordinary meeting. I guess the equivalent would be this special shareholder meeting here in the US. But that is an interesting, that's a very interesting point that you can do that. But when you have that ability to do that, you may not need to do it as much, right? Because you have that gives you more leverage in negotiation.
I think so. I think so. And management in Europe is certainly as sensible as the counterpart in America. And so I think ultimately they do see the writing on the wall when that writing becomes clear enough. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. I always hear about clubby boards in a lot of European jurisdictions. And I suspect that you've come across a lot of clubby boards there as well.
I have, but as an investor in gold miners, there is never an industry or geography that I have happened upon that has been as thickly brushed with a paint of clubby board discount as the gold mining sector in Canada, right? Like extraordinary period of underperformance. And everybody says, it's very clubby. All these board members know each other and nothing will ever change. And I'm thrilled and grateful for everybody who's expressed that view over time, which has been most of the observers in it, because it's actually completely incorrect. And it's most conducive to lazy investors. I'm not going to try because nothing ever happens. Well, good for you. Creates more opportunities for us. Mm-hmm. I think that in today's day and age where information is so much more quickly disseminated, and I think that the tolerance for corporate misbehavior is much lower than it was maybe even a number of years ago, I don't really know that I believe in clubby boards being the bastion and the stronghold for inept value destructive management teams. At the end of the day, if a company honors its investors' rights, and if there's nothing in the corporate governance or the bylaws that prevent investors from imposing their will on the company, make your board as clubby as you want. If you're doing a terrible job, we will come and we will replace the board and we will replace management, and you will rue the day that you try to get away with doing nonsensical stuff because you have a clubby board and a whole bunch of people who are in your pocket. So I don't think so.
No, that's interesting. You also mentioned that in Canada, where I suspect you do a lot of investing with your mining investments. And we've done articles about this. It's actually very kind of activist friendly in many ways, where you can call special shareholder meetings and things like that fairly easily and with low investment thresholds. But let's talk a little about the mining a bit. And I wanted to get into one of my favorite subjects related to activism, which is this, and I hate the term ESG investing activism, the environmental social governance governance investing. You know, know a lot. We just talked a little bit about the governance side. I wanted to talk a little about the E side, the environmental side. You noted in a recent Globe and Mail newspaper editorial that ESG funds often must pledge the UN principles for responsible investing and follow certain green investment guidelines, which means that they eschew any dirty companies or industries. And it's true that a lot of ESG funds aren't investing in companies that are big carbon emitters, for example. Yeah, and so you say this makes no sense. So explain.
Well, Ron, so two things to talk about there. What I really meant is I think that the whole ESG investment industry has been completely tarnished by the obvious fact that most players in it are doing it from a marketing perspective, you know, and they're trying to do it as easily as they can, which means that they invest in companies that they can tell to the world, this is a green company, it emits less carbon, it has a lower carbon footprint per unit of output than its peers, therefore it's the best in the sector. And that's what we're investing in our portfolio, and give us your money because we're making the world a better place. You know, to people who do this, I have no polite word to say, so I will not voice my actual thoughts. I mean,
it sounds like you're suggesting that the real ESG activism has to happen at carbon emitters, at the companies that are
I'm thankful that that word also didn't. Yeah, look, I've spent 23 years in New York, so at this point, I think that my language tends to take on my like New York background. But I just find it extraordinarily lazy, both intellectually, and I find it completely ineffective. And I'm very offended by it, and really upset, frankly. Partly because I actually really care about the environmental output that companies have around the world and the completely nefarious impact they've had on the environment. And I'm actually very upset about how so many companies underpay their employees and treat their local communities with such contempt, never mind their investors, right? I think that corporate culture has taken this mantra of shareholder returns at all costs to mean, you know, returns for top management, compensation for top management at all costs, and has really eschewed, I think, the rights of a lot of other stakeholders. And that personally bothers me. But very tangibly speaking, here's what I don't like about these lazy and effective passive ESG investors. And I don't blame the PRI, which is kind of loosely affiliated with the UN, but a separate organization. I don't blame the PRI at all. But here's basically what most funds do. They come in, they pick a number of companies that on paper and based on data that isn't directly comparable and that isn't consistent at all, and that is usually backward looking. They're like, look, we are investing in companies that are green. They're better operators. They're better. They emit less carbon than everybody else. And therefore, we have a green portfolio. Therefore, invest in us. And I think that that's just not going to make the world a better place. Okay. Because the truth is that we all drive cars. We all catch planes. We all make use of plastics in our everyday lives a lot more than we should. Okay. And so these industries create products that there's fundamentally consistent demand for. Okay. And for us to try to ignore this and to say, okay, well, I'm not investing in any of the companies that invest in these things gives the management teams and the boards of these companies carte blanche to operate however they like and to not care about the environmental pollution that they emit, to not care about the communities that they deal with to the extent that they can get away with it, because there's no investor that's going to come and hold them responsible and vote against them if they're not good custodians of the environment. Do you know what I mean? Whereas conversely, if we did invest in companies that mine the resources that we need, if we want to green the world and work off of an electric network rather than off of like decayed dinosaurs, which is what we're using to fuel our cars and our planes, if we actually want to make that transition, we're going to have to extract a lot of metals and minerals to conduct and contain that electricity. That means that mining is going to be a booming industry. And I think that actually investing in miners and proactively forcing the management teams and these boards to adopt cleaner mining practices and technologies is going to decrease the impact on the planet a lot more than avoiding it altogether. I liken it to like a classroom. We investors have a lot of power in our hands. And if we don't wield it, that's an active choice as well. And most don't wield it because they're too lazy and don't know how. But I think if you're an investor, you own a company, you have a responsibility to make sure that company behaves well. And so I think that actually what you need to do is understand how to make your companies better and engage with management and the board and make sure that they're on an ever improving course from an environmental and social perspective. I think that that actually is a lot more sensible than making these passive investments.
Okay, so maybe we could kind of narrow in on that a little bit. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little about what kind of mining companies you invest in and what are you doing specifically to try to reduce the environmental cost of mining at some of the miners you invest in.
We have an advisory board that is made up of some of the leading operators and CEOs from the industries in which we invest. And these people, if we do really, really detailed work and inspired work, I will absolutely give credit to our advisors. They are amazing. They're some of the, they are the very best operators and CEOs from the industries where we invest. They identify our investment candidates for us. They do operational due diligence for us. They put together our activist plans. We're involved every step of the way, but really we dig a lot deeper because of their irreplicable, from my perspective, industrial insights. Two of our advisors, you know, one of our advisors used to be the head of sustainability at BHP Billiton, and the other one used to be the economist in charge of renewable resources at the U.S. Treasury and has spent his life focused on ESG. We, through the connectivity that we have and the relationships that we have found, for example, one company that has a water treatment technology that meaningfully decreases the concentration of chemicals and pollutants that are used by the mining industry in the water that is returned to the environment from the mine. So in the effluent water. So basically, you know, they're a water treatment company and they're much more effective than existing solutions that are adopted. We found another company that has a technology that allows miners to fracture the rock into much smaller sediments and much smaller rock pieces that have a much greater surface area, which makes it a lot easier for the coveted mineral to leach out of these rocks. And so because of that, you need a lot less chemicals to leach that rock because you don't need to erode the rock base in order to leach out the chemical. The rock base has a lot more surface area. And that, again, can make a really dramatic impact on the environmental output of the mining companies that we invest in. So we identified these technologies. We do a lot of due diligence with them. It's not as easy as I wish it were because, you know, many companies make claims that, in fact, don't end up being correct. But when we find a company that's got a good technology, we introduce it to the management teams of all of our companies and make sure they meet with and test the technology. And if they don't adopt it, there better be a really good reason why. And then I was an investor in Petrobras, you know, a number of years ago when Petrobras was thinking about building a pipeline that would crisscross the Amazon to export its oil all the way to North America. That pipeline was going to go through the Amazon, through like virgin parts of the Amazon. And for sure, it was going to have leaks. All pipelines do. It was going to have leaks in like maybe the last really like existentially important ecosystem we have on this planet of ours. And the pipeline wasn't even going to be economically, was going to have an economic yield associated with it. It was just like a, like an exercise in being part of the big boys club in the energy market in North America. And I put together a consortium of fellow investors. And basically we all sent a letter to management and the board saying, you better cease and desist from pursuing this. Otherwise we're going to vocally vote against your reinstatement to the board every year until each of you is kicked off. And within a couple of weeks, they disbanded the project. So I just think that investors really.
That sounds like a whole other level compared to the Keystone XL pipeline saga that we've been listening to in Canada, US. Yeah, I didn't realize Petrobras was thinking of doing that. So that's quite impressive.
I mean, all of these are really objectionable projects. And I find it really, really stupid, frankly, that people go and they protest the Keystone XL pipeline by disrupting the work of the construction crew that has absolutely no discretion over the project, right? It's symbolic at best. The people you really should be going after is the CEO sitting at his $30 million house up in Aspen, or you should be going after the board members of the company. Most people don't even know what the name of the company is that owns a Keystone XL pipeline. And that is clearly by design. Go after their board members. Go after, and by the way, this is what that's nobody does. Go after their shareholders. Okay. That's how you put real pressure on the system. Because that's these really shareholders have one thing that they value above all else. It's their reputation. So you go and you publicly name and shame them for funding an environmentally destructive project. Believe me, you will be heard. You will have impact. Nobody's done that yet. And I hope nobody listens to this because I mean to. And, you know,
that could be the next big ESG proxy fight.
Yeah, just going. Yeah, I mean, listen. I'm not a politician in this country, but it seems to me like there are news networks that clearly and consistently disseminate false information to the point where it's rackled the very foundations of democracy. Like, there really should be no reason for people to ask whether the election in this country was legitimate or not. And so the investors in that company are directly tied to, very clearly, the unshackling of democratic beliefs in America, which has impact all around the world. Because for decades, America has gone all around this great planet of ours and said, we are the model to follow and you must do what we do and we're the best and we're the smartest and you must follow our model. Fine. Everybody's bought into the America. Everybody's drunk the American Kool-Aid. The consensus that America wanted, which is that the American way of life is the best, is a consensus that the world has adopted. And now America wants to go fascist and doesn't care about democracy and doesn't care about the rule of law. Well, what do you think that's going to, what impact is that going to have on the rest of the world? The answer is extraordinarily scary, I think, as someone who has lived in places where democracy, you know, where like democratic institutions didn't exist. And it seems very clear to me that there are very specific news outlets and places like Facebook that continuously disseminate false information because they make money at it and because they have a willing audience who will eat this. And I think that the investors in those companies and the board members of these companies have a lot to answer for.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So are you suggesting that there just isn't enough news media coverage of the corporate structures of some of these environmental
pollutants? There isn't. Isn't. Okay. Yeah, there isn't. Okay. To me, it seems, again, I get very frustrated by these things because it seems pretty obvious to me. But then I have to remember that I've been doing this for like decades. And, you know, I grew up all over the place and I have met all kinds of people and I've met with most of the CEOs of all of the largest companies around the world. And so even if I were seriously undergifted mentally, I've had a lot of exposure to people who have helped me understand how the world works. And so it all seems pretty clear. But I think that most people don't understand where the levers of power actually are and how decisions actually are made. And I think that they try to affect change in a completely, ultimately ineffective way.
No, that is very interesting. And I totally agree with you now that you put it that way. Okay, I have to ask you, you know, not all of the ESG funds eschew dirty companies. And obviously you have been, you know, pushing on environmental issues that the miners that you invest in. But there's, you know, one of probably the biggest proxy fight in terms of the market caps of the targeted company is this Engine Number One's proxy fight at Exxon. And now there's talk that Exxon will put Jeff Ubin, the founder of ValueAct, who started his own ESG fund, Inclusive Capital Partners, on the board, which a lot of people suspect could hurt the Engine Number One's campaign there. But I don't know. What do you think of all this? It seems like it's a very small fund that launched this proxy fight. They're trying to bring on some people with renewable resource experience and someone with some oil and gas experience onto Exxon's board, which just put their first guy with, you know, the board had until recently had nobody with any oil and gas experience on it, which, you know, they had a lot of Fortune 500 people, but it was very surprising to me that they had nobody with former executive with oil and gas experience on Exxon's board, and definitely, you know, nobody with a renewable resource background in the C-suite renewable resource background. So I don't know, what do you think about this campaign? How do you think this might play out?
Yeah, look, I haven't studied this investment in detail, I must admit. A couple of thoughts. So let me not comment on the merits of Engine One's proposals, but just share a couple of general observations.
About sure.
First of all, Jeff Ubin. A lot of people portray themselves as ESG-focused activists and whatever. I am, unfortunately, of the view that most of them are doing it from a marketing perspective. Jeff Ubin, for me, is one of the few people who talks the talk and walks the walk and actually really cares about the impact that his investments have. I know him not as well as I would like because I really greatly admire him. I think that he is pretty focused on having a positive impact through the influence and the power that he knows he has and he understands that we investors have. So I would be very positively predisposed to what he does. I find him very thoughtful. He's thoughtful, he's effective, and he's got the right intentions. Okay. And the general population of people who meet these criteria are like maybe there's three of them in North America among top investors, right? And that's being very generous. And I do like to think of myself as one of them.
I figured you would.
Who the third person is, I don't know. I'll let you know what I mean. There we go. There's James losing all his friends. I didn't have that many to begin with.
So do you think it would be a positive development if Jeff Ubin got on the board of Exxon?
I just cannot I did a lot of debating up in Canada when I was a kid, and I used to debate both sides of an issue. And at some point, I got really concerned because I was like, oh my God, when I grew up, I'm never going to be able to have an opinion, because I trained myself to see both sides of an issue so well that I thought I could never have an opinion again. I would have a really tough time debating against Jeff Ubben joining the board of any company. So that's reaction. Okay. Reaction two, I love the idea of, you know, interjecting fresh blood with a completely different perspective on the board of a company. Okay. Mm-hmm. But it has to make sense, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of people have done that with great success by injecting people with technology backgrounds or artificial mm-hmm. intelligence backgrounds or payment system backgrounds or, you know, PR backgrounds or whatever on the boards of, or finance backgrounds on the boards of consumer goods companies, you know, or people with a consumer background or with a design background on the boards of technology companies. That kind of cross-pollination of talent obviously makes sense because it is tangential to, but increasingly coincident with, the needs of a company that operates in the consumer space. Like if you have a tech background, increasingly you're relevant to a consumer goods company, right? Mm-hmm. Blah, blah, blah.
But right, definitely.
At the end of the day, Exxon is an energy company and it is mostly an extractive resources. And the idea of appointing someone who comes from neither of these industries just because the company needs to go into a new direction, in a way, speaks about the desperate need for new ideas that haven't been come up with yet. And you put these people in place hoping that they come up with something, mm-hmm. you know? And in my experience, investing on the idea of hope, you might as well put your money on Bitcoin, you know? Which is a whole other topic. But I think that really as an activist investor, what you need to have is a very clearly defined vision for what needs to happen with the company. Mm-hmm. And you need to be able to prove that your vision is the correct one. So it needs to be verifiable externally. And mm-hmm. then you need to appoint the right people to implement that vision. And very often that would be the actual architects of that vision. But the idea of merely putting the right people in place and hoping that they come up with the right solution, that does work, but not as well. And then putting people who may be the right people, I think, is getting into the second derivative of hope. And to me, that just becomes very difficult to get enthusiastic about.
All right. So reading between the tea leaves of your comments, it sounds like you're suggesting that if Jeff Ubben doesn't have a very specific plan or strategy that he's, you know, this is obviously not a campaign he launched like he might have had when he was at Value Act at other areas. Unless he has a very strong strategy that the company's willing to engage with, you're not 100% certain that adding him to this, I don't know, what, 9-member board or whatever, will have a big impact.
I meant people who come from industry. So I do think that there's one exception to that rule. Maybe it's self-serving and maybe that's what people think, and I don't care. I do think that people who come from the kind of background that Jeff has have garnered experience in a variety of industries. And his expertise is value creation from companies in a number of industries. So I would view him as someone who can bring value to the board of whatever kind of company, regardless of industry. But I was reacting to the idea of people who have industrial rather than investment backgrounds, but that come from industries that have nothing to do with Exxon.
I see.
But that maybe have a demonstrable track record of creative thinking. And I think that those people better stay home.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting because I wonder whether the Exxon's board has a number of those, but we won't get into that. So we don't have a lot of time. So I know I have like a whole bunch of questions I didn't have time to ask, but I thought maybe very briefly we could go back to your investing in the gold mine sector. So one, have you found a lot of, beyond the environmental inputs you're hoping to provide to these companies, do you find that there's a lot of problem management of gold miners? And second, do you feel like you predict that there should be a wave of consolidation in gold miners? You think that that's necessary? And I'm wondering if you have done anything to help drive M&A in gold mining.
We can make it very brief. And my answer is yes, yes, lots.
You know? Maybe just a little bit more detail, but that's good. That's good. Yeah. I like that.
Yes, and lots. Look, yeah, I've been investing for 23 years, and I love investing in things that I think are trading for a fraction of their actual value. I love buying things personally that I think are being sold for a fraction of their value. It's kind of the chemistry or the circuitry of my physical being. I just love a good deal. I don't know why. I couldn't explain it to you. I sort of thrive on it. You know, some people eat a lot, and unfortunately I do. Some people like to drink. I really don't. But I love getting a great deal. That's what gives me my kicks in life. Mm-hmm. And you know what? 23 years of investing, looking everywhere, and I've been very lucky and have found a lot of really great companies and very low valuations. I have never found anything like the opportunity set I'm finding in gold mining today. I'll just leave it at that. It's very difficult to take advantage of. You need to understand geology. You need to understand mine engineering. You need to understand the history of the sector. You need to understand the jurisdiction risks. You need to understand who you're dealing with and what their M&A wishes are, blah, blah, blah. And it's taken us 5 years to put together an advisory board that includes some of the leading operators and CEOs and mine engineers from the industry. And we understand all that. And like, I love the fact that nobody cares about the mining industry and the gold mining industry. And I hope that nobody does for like at least another 2 years, because there's so much for us to do.
Mm-hmm. And you predict that there'll be some consolidation in gold mining?
There already is. There already is. Okay. 20% up in Europe. Tell you what, how about you double that in terms of M&A that we're seeing in the gold mining space? There is so much consolidation there needs to be. Don't listen to me. Nobody knows me. Nobody, you know, and that's great. Listen to the CEOs of the largest gold miners. The one thing they all say, we need to have a lot of consolidation. They're all saying it because they're not discovering any more gold. So they need, you know, but anyway, look, we have a whole big thesis and it's been working out well for us. And frankly, the fewer people get involved, the happier we are.
Do you think you might launch an activist campaign at a gold mine? Like in terms of activist campaign, a public activist campaign, obviously you know, you're doing a lot of engagement really, behind the scenes, which is activism too.
Every company that we're investing in, we find that there's a lot of room for improvement. Well, not every company. There are some companies that we're investing in where like management is doing great things with their assets. But even in cases where there's room for improvement, we have a really, and I think for me, surprisingly positive discussion with management and the board. And we really view ourselves as not James Raste, but James Raste plus my partner, Chad Tappendorf, plus much more importantly, our advisors. Between all of us, we do some really, really detailed work that points to how value can be created from the companies that we invest in. And we're really thrilled with the fact that the average management team and board is very receptive to the ideas that we have. And so we're not fixing for a fight. And we certainly find that there's a lot of people who we are thrilled to be investing into and in discussion with. And we have no doubt that they will create a lot of value from their companies.
All right. Well, we'll be keeping an eye on Coast Capital and its investing in the mining sector to come. And so, James, I really appreciate you taking a little time to talk to us. You've been listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast with Ron Orrell, and we've been talking to James Raste of Coast Capital. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Great to speak with you, Ron.